From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! We're broadcasting from San Francisco.
Of its limitations. It cuts off both ends of every discussion. The media is that way for a reason, which is this country, the center of this country, the corporations, are determined to control the thing.
Norman Mailer, the legendary novelist and journalist, is dead. He was 84 years old. We'll play a conversation I had with him about the 2004 elections, the state of protest today, and about the historic 1968 Chicago Convention. But first, a federal criminal investigation opens into the 58,000-gallon oil spill in the San Francisco Bay. And a storm is brewing at the University of California over the $500 million partnership that BP is making with the university. We'll speak with two professors there. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistan's military leader, General Pervez Musharraf, has announced parliamentary elections will be held on January 9th, but he's refused to say whether he will lift martial law. Musharraf declared emergency law 9 days ago. Since then, thousands of his critics have been arrested, public rallies have been outlawed, and independent networks, including the BBC and CNN, have been taken off the air. On Sunday, Pakistan's attorney general announced military courts could now try civilians on charges ranging from treason to inciting public unrest. General Musharraf continues to defend his decision to impose martial law.
The emergency reinforces the war on terror. So therefore, all that I can say is, I do understand that emergency has to be lifted, but I cannot give a date for it. We are in a difficult situation, and therefore I cannot give a date.
Opposition leader Benazir Bhutto announced earlier today that she has ended negotiations with Musharraf for a power-sharing agreement. On Tuesday, Bhutto plans to lead a 185-mile protest caravan from Lahore to Islamabad. On Friday, she spoke to reporters while she was under temporary house arrest.
For Benazir Bhutto, this is not a battle for Pakistan People's Party. This is a battle to save Pakistan. To save Pakistan from the forces of extremism.
Meanwhile, Newsweek reports Pakistan has released several senior Taliban commanders, including Mullah Ahud, the highest-ranking Taliban official captured by the Pakistanis. Taliban sources told the magazine that he was released one day after Musharraf declared martial law. He once served as defense minister for the Taliban and was one of the closest confidants to Taliban leader Mullah Omar. The Taliban leaders were released as part of a prisoner exchange. Former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik has been indicted on federal corruption charges, including bribery and tax fraud. If convicted on all 16 counts, he could face 142 years in prison and charged with almost $5 million in fines. Kerik's indictment could present a complication in Rudolph Giuliani's run for the White House. As mayor of New York, Giuliani elevated Kerik to corrections commissioner and then police commissioner. Later, Giuliani made Kerik a partner in his security business and urged President Bush to nominate Kerik to be head of the Department of Homeland Security. The Observer newspaper of London reports the Pentagon is putting huge pressure on U.S. interrogators in hopes of finding incriminating evidence about Iran. Micah Brose, a privately contracted interrogator working for the American forces in Iraq, told the Observer information on Iran is gold. Brose said, quote, they push for use to establish a link with Iran. They have pre-categories for us to go through. And of all the recent requests I've had, I'd say 60% to 70% are about Iran. Brose went on to say, quote, if nothing changes in the current course, I'd say military action is inevitable. Last week, the Interpress Service reported a national intelligence estimate on Iran has been held up for more than a year. It's reportedly part of an effort by President Dick Cheney to pressure intelligence analysts to remove any dissenting judgment about Iran's alleged nuclear weapons program. Another U.S. private military company is being accused of killing an innocent Iraqi civilian. On Saturday, a guard from DynCorp International reportedly shot and killed an Iraqi taxi driver in Baghdad. Three witnesses told the New York Times the taxi had posed no threat. A spokesperson for the Iraqi Interior Ministry said, quote, "They just killed a man and drove away." The Wall Street Journal reports the U.S. Navy is quietly building a military installation atop one of Iraq's offshore oil export terminals. The new installation will house U.S., British, and Australian officers and sailors and will serve as a U.S.-controlled command post straddling a major component of Iraq's oil industry. The Journal also reports the new offshore outpost offers a convenient perch from which to monitor Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps. 2007 has become the deadliest year for U.S. troops in Afghanistan. On Friday, six U.S. soldiers died in an ambush in eastern Afghanistan. The deaths brought the total number of U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan this year to at least 101. 2007 has also been the deadliest year for U.S. troops in Iraq. In Somalia, at least 80 people have died in the capital of Mogadishu in heavy fighting between U.S.-backed Ethiopian troops and Somali fighters. Most of the dead are believed to be civilians. The BBC reported Ethiopian tanks and artillery battered paths of Mogadishu after an Ethiopian soldier was dragged through the streets. Residents of Mogadishu accused Ethiopian troops of attacking civilians.
We are witnesses to the problems the Ethiopian troops brought for us. They killed every person they saw in the area, and we have now decided to flee the capital, Mogadishu.
The UN estimates 100,000 people have left Mogadishu in the last 2 weeks to escape the fighting. U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said 1.5 million Somalis are now in need of humanitarian assistance. Human Rights Watch says the failure of the international community to end the violence in Somalia selects a contempt for the values of African life. In Cambodia, police have arrested two leading figures from the Khmer Rouge on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity. The former foreign minister has been arrested. Yang Sari and his wife, Yang Thirith, were arrested in Phnom Penh, the capital of Cambodia. They're due to appear before judges at a UN-backed genocide tribunal. Authorities from Russia and Ukraine have launched a rescue and cleanup operation in the Black Sea after heavy storms sank five ships, including an oil tanker. At least three sailors have died and 20 remain missing. The oil tanker spilled more than 1,000 tons of fuel oil after it split in half. Three cargo ships, each carrying more than 2,000 tons of sulfur, also sank. Officials said it could be the worst environmental disaster in the region in years and could take years to clean up. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon traveled to Antarctica on Friday and called for urgent political action to tackle global warming. He spoke during a tour of three scientific bases on the Antarctic continent, where temperatures are their highest in about 1,800 years.
Again, I was told by the scientists that entire Western Antarctica is now floating. This is one-fifth of a total continent, size of this total continent. If it broke up, the sea level rise, sea level may rise as much as 6 meters, 18 feet. This is very alarming.
Climate change protests were held in 60 towns and cities across Australia. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California has announced she favors granting legal immunity for telecommunications companies that allegedly shared millions of customers' telephone and email messages and records with the government. The San Francisco Chronicle reports Feinstein could cast a pivotal vote when the Senate Judiciary Committee takes up the issues this week. In a statement, Feinstein said lawsuits filed against Verizon, AT&T, and other telecoms are unfair because the companies are unable to defend themselves in court since the governments insist their activity be kept secret. A new study by Physicians for Social Responsibility estimates health care for Iraq veterans could top $650 billion. The group titled its report, "Shock and Awe Hits Home." The study marks the first attempt to isolate the financial costs of the wide-ranging traumatic mental and social effects of the Iraq War. Since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, at least 60,000 U.S. service members have been wounded or become mentally ill. Due to advances in body armor and battlefield medicine, the ratio of wounded to killed is 8-1. Compared with 3-1 during the Vietnam War and 2-1 for World War II. The percentage of amputees is the highest since the Civil War. The Los Angeles Police Department has launched an extensive mapping program to identify Muslim enclaves across the city. LAPD Deputy Chief Michael Downing told the Los Angeles Times, quote, "We want to know where the Pakistanis, Iranians, and Chechens are so we can reach out to those communities," he said. But the mapping program has sparked outrage from some Islamic groups and civil libertarians. The American Civil Liberties Union says the program is nothing short of racial profiling. In Washington state, more than 1,000 people packed into Seattle's town hall Friday to voice opposition to the Federal Communications Commission's plans to rewrite the nation's media ownership laws to allow for greater media consolidation. The FCC gave just 5 business days' notice for the public hearing. Washington Governor Christine Gregoire says she's opposed to further concentration of media ownership through consolidation of the media.
Available to each of us as citizens, and it is clearly unhealthy in a society that rests on principles of equality and diversity. I find it ironic that in an age with so many new ways for people to communicate and so many ways to exercise the literal beauty of democracy, we face the very real threat that those new ways will be controlled by but a few.
In Olympia, Washington, 15 anti-war demonstrators were arrested over the weekend while attempting to block a military convoy carrying Stryker vehicles. The protests were organized by the Olympia Port Militarization Resistance, which tries to stop the U.S. military from using the port of Olympia to ship equipment to Iraq. Protest organizers also accused police of brutalizing dozens of peaceful demonstrators and journalists. On Saturday, police dressed in riot gear repeatedly used pepper spray and batons to break up the protest. The 2-time Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist and journalist Norman Mailer has died at the age of 84. He was the author of many books, including The Executioner's Song and The Naked and the Dead. In 1955, he helped found The Village Voice. We'll have an excerpt of a Norman Mailer interview I did in 2004, just before the conventions. And finally, an 8-year-old from Bethesda, Maryland, is making headlines this week after winning a $5,000 prize from the toy company Legos. Kelsey Kimberlin was one of 10 children to win Legos' first annual Creativity Awards. In order to win the award, she wrote an essay saying her creativity came through singing songs like Happy Springtime, a reworking of John Lennon's Happy Christmas. A video of Kelsey singing the song was also posted on YouTube. In the song, her father changed the lyrics to the song from "Happy Christmas, War is Over" to "Happy Springtime, Bush is Over."
Bush is over. If you want it, glory is over. Now
officials from Lagos claim they didn't see the video before awarding Kelsey Kimberlin the prize money. When asked to describe her winning entry, Kelsey told the Washington Post, quote, "I don't want kids to lose any parents in the war." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from San Francisco, where a criminal investigation has been opened into the 58,000-gallon spill of heavy bunker fuel into the San Francisco Bay. The spill took place when a container ship slammed into the San Francisco Golden Gate Bridge Wednesday. The San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge. Coast Guard officials acknowledged on Friday that they had waited over 4 hours before notifying the public of the magnitude of the spill. They'd previously reported a leak of just 140 gallons. The oil spill has shut down over a dozen beaches and killed at least 60 birds. Ecologists warn it could take months to clean up and that it threatens the bay's diverse ecosystem, including several endangered species. Environmental organizations like Friends of the Earth and San Francisco Baykeeper have condemned the ecological impact of the spill and the slowness of the official response. They're also calling for a ban on the shipping industry's use of the heavily polluting bunker fuel, which they say is 1,000 times worse for the environment than highway diesel. We're joined now by Sejal Choksi, who is the program director at San Francisco Baykeeper, which is an organization that aims to protect and enhance the water quality of the San Francisco Bay. She's the environmental representative to the California Office of Spill Prevention and Response Technical Advisory Committee. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good morning.
Talk about the enormity of what has taken place here in the last few days.
So essentially what we're looking at is the worst spill from a vessel in a decade in the San Francisco Bay. So we've got 58,000 gallons of this bunker fuel that's basically entered our environment. And because of the slow response from the agencies, it's been allowed to essentially spread throughout the estuary. And this is a very sensitive estuary, so we're really concerned about
How did the ship hit the bridge?
Essentially, what happened is that the bar pilot that was in charge of navigating the vessel caught it too close to the side of the tower of the bridge. And so what happened is that the hull scraped the side of the bridge and ended up putting about a 100-foot gash into the hull.
Explain what bunker oil is, why they were carrying. They were going to South Korea?
Yes. Bunker fuel is essentially the fuel that cargo ships use in order to move to facilitate their fueling. And so the bunker fuel is actually one of the dirtiest and most polluting types of fuel. It's essentially what's left from the refining process. It's kind of a waste product almost. So it ends up being one of the heaviest and one of the dirtiest types of fuel. And it contains pretty toxic chemicals like polyaromatic hydrocarbons, and those include naphthalene and benzene. It also ends up having a lot of heavy metals like mercury. And these contaminants get into the water and essentially have carcinogenic impacts as well as developmental and immunological impacts on the critters that are in the estuary.
You're calling on Congress to ban the bunker oil from being used or transported in this country?
Exactly. What we believe is that if these vessels were not using this type of toxic fuel, then you know, when these types of accidents happened, we wouldn't be in such a chaotic situation at this moment. So if they were to ban the use of this type of fuel, the vessels would have to use a different type of fuel, and that would mean that it would be more environmentally safe. One of the other things about bunker fuel is that it is contributing to greenhouse gases. So,
What way?
When it is burned as fuel, it gives off a lot of the really horrible chemicals and pollutants that are contributing to greenhouse gases because it is one of the dirtiest types of fuels.
Explain how this spill has affected the bay. What's happened to the birds, to the ecology of the area, and what you foresee happening?
So it's had a pretty huge impact. Baykeeper patrols the bay and has patrolled the bay for the last 5 days since the spill. And every day that we are out, we have noticed an oily sheen on the water in almost every location that we've been. And in certain locations, we've seen that every 2 or 3 inches, there are huge globs about, you know, orange or grapefruit-sized globs of bunker fuel just in the water. And we've witnessed harbor seals and sea lions actually swimming through those globs of fuel. We've also noticed birds that are landing in it and, you know, getting covered in it, essentially. So the latest numbers are actually showing that over 200 birds have been captured that have this oil all over them. And that essentially causes a multitude of problems for the birds. It can cause them to lose their thermal protection. It can also cause them to be smothered and drowned, so essentially they can't fly away. And it can also cause them to ingest the oil because through their preening, they're trying to clean it off of themselves, but they end up ingesting it. And so that can be toxic and harmful to the birds as well.
Are there things people can do to help? I've been reading a lot of articles about just the overwhelming response just by citizens in the Bay Area, but not being able to get involved, asking if they can help.
Right. The outpouring of support has been astonishing. We've had over 4,000 people contact Baykeeper itself just to find out how they can help. And what's really been unfortunate is that the agency's response has been, please stay away from the beaches. We don't need your help. You will be getting in the way of our cleanup efforts. And so up until today, the agencies have basically been turning people away. And instead, what they've been doing is spending their resources citing and arresting people who have been trying to do cleanups kind of unofficially. And we've thought that that was a waste of time. So we've been pressuring the agencies to actually provide hazardous materials trainings so that people who are really interested in getting out there can actually help make a difference. And so as of today, they will be providing some minimal training to some volunteers. So hopefully we can help with this cleanup effort.
How will it affect fish like the herring?
Essentially, we're looking at impacts for decades. Polyaromatic hydrocarbons are some of the most toxic and contaminating pollutants that basically don't degrade. They remain in the environment for a very long time, especially in an aquatic environment. So we're essentially looking at a very contaminated environment for just decades to come.
Are there things people can do outside of the Bay Area around this issue, or are you focusing totally on Congress now simply to ban the use of bunker oil?
Well, I think the banning of this type of fuel can be a nationwide issue, and people can put pressure on Congress nationwide to do this. You know, one of the other things we could do is put pressure on Congress to require the use of double-hulled vessels. That's already required for oil tankers in this country after the Exxon Valdez spill. But for these cargo ships, they don't require double hulls. And if this ship, the Costco Busan, had a double hull, this accident would probably not have occurred.
Sejal Choksi, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Sejal Choksi is with the San Francisco Bay Keeper. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We come back in a minute. Max Johnson here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. There is a controversy raging at the University of California, Berkeley, where British Petroleum, where BP, they've called themselves now Beyond Petroleum, has promised to give $500 million to the university over the next 10 years. The deal would fund the development of, quote, sustainable, commercially viable, and environmentally friendly sources of energy. The newly created Energy Biosciences Institute, or EBI, claims to promote research into biofuels as well as bacteria that would increase energy production from oil and coal. Critics at UC Berkeley point to the corporatization of academic research, the ecological dangers of biofuels, and BP's long history of environmental irresponsibility, they say. They call this an act of greenwashing by BP and have been protesting the deal since it was announced in February of this year. But supporters claim that the corporate academic partnership allows the university to realize its renewable energy research agenda and provide the most effective and economic means of addressing the looming environmental crisis. To talk about this issue, we're joined by two professors at UC Berkeley. Miguel Altieri is a professor of entomology. He is a renowned expert in agroecology, or sustainable agriculture. He's opposed to the deal between BP and UC Berkeley. He joins us here at Link TV Studios in San Francisco. Daniel Kamen is a professor of energy and resources, a professor of public policy and nuclear engineering. He directs the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory and is on the executive committee of the Energy Biosciences Institute, which will carry out much of the research under this deal. Well, we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Professor Kamen. Why do you think this $500 million that BP has promised over the next 10 years is good for the university?
Well, there's a couple features. One is that we clearly need to learn more about biofuels, and we need to learn about them in a way that emphasizes the sustainability. The biofuel industry right now is taking off around the world, and it's unfortunately being based largely on feedstocks that are bad on an energy balance and bad for many communities on a profit balance and bad for many communities in terms of trading off their food needs versus fuel needs. And so the need to develop a serious research agenda to find out the better ways to do this, or in fact whether we should do this at all, is in fact the reason why we need to begin these sorts of programs, not just at Berkeley, but hopefully around the world.
Now, the issue of BP giving this enormous sum of money, $500 million over the next 10 years, is this of concern to you, the issue of the privatization of a public institution?
Well, I think the size of the grant, it can be a concern, but not for the reasons that you're raising. I actually think that this amount of money is relatively small change, both for the oil industries around the world and, in fact, for the amount of money it takes to bring new products to market. New cars and new drugs frequently take that much money, $500 million, to bring them to market. And as a research pot of money to start with, I actually don't regard it as that much money. The chance, though, that this amount of money would alter what a university does is a concern to me. And the degree to which a university might see grants like this as a reason or as an excuse or as a mechanism to alter what they would work on, to, say, move away from some areas and move into others, is a concern if it was being done in a way that I thought that the company had that driving force. And so far in the process here, I've been quite pleased with the degree to which the intellectual terms of the discussion, in terms of what to study, not the broader politics of biofuels, has been well represented. Whether that continues or not is something that we're hopefully going to be vigilant to and look at, but I don't think it's a guaranteed feature that you will necessarily be able to steer clear of that. It's going to take a degree of oversight to make sure that we don't have corporate interests running essentially what U.S. or other universities would do.
Professor Altieri, your concerns.
Well, my concerns is that First of all, Professor Kamen is saying it's very little money, and eventually it's little money for BP, but a lot of money for UC Berkeley. And what they're going to do with this money is basically skim off what 200 years of public investment has done. It would be very expensive for BP to build a university and a research facility. They all come with $500 million. They skim off what the public university has built over years. And then they bring 50 scientists from BP that are going to have access to students. And so, therefore, what they're going to do is influence the research agenda of the public university. And it's already happening.
How?
Well, a lot of fields that should be emphasized at Berkeley are dying off, like biological pest control, alternatives to pesticides, agroecology, sustainable agriculture. And they are emphasizing fields of biotechnology and genetic engineering and et cetera. And basically what the chancellor has done is basically has put in power in a position of power people that are chemists, engineers, and chemists and genetic engineering and so on in charge of an agenda of complex ecological issues rather than ecologists. Ecologists have been actually, most of them that are critic, have been actually taken out of any dealings with this deal.
Has the deal been signed?
No. As far as I know, not.
Do you know, Professor Kamen? It sounds like there's a lot of speculation, also a lot of concern about the transparency of this. Have the heads of BP and the heads of University of California signed on the dotted line?
No, they haven't. There's actually still quite a bit of debate still going as to how to structure it, largely around the reasons that that Miguel mentioned, because the structure of the proposal that we wrote, and I was one of the authors of the initial proposal, not of the final legal deal, which is being handled by the legal teams, but of the final, but of the initial plan that we sent to BP, was in fact one that I thought addressed many of these issues, and they're still being debated today, and that was that research done on the University of California side and that of our partners, and our partners in this deal include the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which is a government lab run by the University of California, and working out the arrangements so that work done on so-called our side of that equation is fully the intellectual property of our team members, not of BP, was a central point in the proposal that we wrote up. And those are the features that are now being discussed, and that's why it has not been finalized yet, trying to work
out
that arrangement.
Well, let's talk about that, Professor Altieri. How does this work? Do employees of BP, I said Beyond Petroleum, that's what the commercials say. I don't think that's actually their name. It's just BP, is that right?
Yeah, BP.
The scientists at BP will work at UC Berkeley?
Well, they will be housed at UC Berkeley. Actually, I understand that the state is going to put $40 to $70 million to build a facility for them in the campus. They're going to have a status of visiting scholars, and they're going to participate in academic life. Supposedly, they need to be invited to do that, but obviously they're going to be doing it, and they're going to be having access to students, having access to research facilities that have been built with public money, and they're going to influence the research agenda. There's no doubt about that. And anybody that has protested, faculty have been basically dismissed and disregarded as part of the colorful character of the campus. You know, we have to have these people that are always protesting. And what worries me is that on the one side, they're promoting the wrong technology. Biofuels is the wrong way to go. Well, there's no discussion, for example, in this proposal about alternative transportation systems, how to curb consumption patterns of petroleum, and how to promote other alternatives that are much more viable. And biofuels are going to cause tremendous problems, not only in the United States, but in third world countries especially, because if we devoted all the corn that is in this country, 125,000 square miles, we would only satisfy 12% of the gas needs. So obviously what's going to happen is that it's going to be grown in the third world. And basically, the people in the third world are going to be paying the price for the overconsumption and the old base style of living of Europe and the United States.
Professor Kamen, your response.
Well, I think there's a couple of really good points in what Miguel just said. The first one is I'm actually as well concerned that I've thought that the debate on campus is not one that has been as open as it could be. And you're right, there's been sort of high-profile protests. But protests and actually having sit-downs between the sides has been somewhat lacking. And I actually really view that as a feature that the campus is responsible for the lack of that, not BP so far. And campus needs to do a better job in that regard. In terms of the fuel issues around the world, I actually take quite a different view than that by Miguel. It is true that if we devoted all of our corn to making ethanol in the U.S., we'd only reach about 10 or 12%. So it wouldn't be a significant effort, and you wouldn't want to give up all that corn use for ethanol. But an interesting, and I think a critical feature of the BP proposal is that, in fact, corn ethanol is excluded. Everyone who works on ethanol and biofuels worldwide recognizes that alternate fuels are available that are far better, the so-called cellulosic crops, that even include using garbage and using the waste carbon dioxide that comes out of power plants on just the land sitting next to those power plants. Those are areas for research in this proposal, not corn. And so if there was to be an approach that would look at alternatives that did not make the tension between food and fuel worse, it's a project like this. And in fact, in many parts of the developing world, the potential to grow crops that are useful for farmers locally at much higher efficiencies than they grow today for food stocks, again, not corn, is an option that this proposal should be looking at. And the degree to which we do a good job there, I think, is very much due to the sort of things that Miguel said, and that is having this broader discussion and analysis, not only of what we should be doing, but also how it goes on.
Professor Altieri.
I think it's going to come too late, because right now what's happening is that corn and soybean and sugarcane are the crops that the corporations, I mean, the University of California BP deal is nothing compared to the tremendous alliance between corporations like ADM, the grain merchants, ADM, Bunge, Cargill, the corporations of petroleum, the corporations of biotechnology, the car corporations, and some environmental groups. And actually, they are promoting already these types of feedstocks that are going to do a huge destruction, deforestation, more gas emissions because of the industrial nature of the agriculture they're going to practice, and so on. So the BP-UC deal is going to come too late with these cellulosic alternatives that Professor Kamen is talking about.
Well, I mean, Professor. I need to jump in there, because on the one hand, you're saying that, well, this is a bad thing. But on the other hand, you're saying that, well, this is an approach that could do it if we did it right. And I actually think that while it's true that we have come relatively recently to cellulosic fuels in the last few years, to then say we shouldn't work on them or that we have no chance to make them a big part of the equation is I think, too early. That might be the case, but it's not yet. And we do need to explore them. And in fact, one of the reasons that California and UC Berkeley was cited for this institute is that the state of California, in work that our lab and others at UC Davis have worked on in detail, is setting standards for our fuels for the future that would, in fact, be cleaner. And the way that we're doing this is around something called the Low Carbon Fuel Standard, which effectively means that if we want to use biofuels, corn is not going to be a feedstock. And the reason for that is that we're rating fuels based on how much greenhouse gases come out. Now, greenhouse gases is not the only environmental concern I have. There's also water and erosion and local land use. But it's the one that is a direct and a first step to allow us to say a fuel that's worse than gasoline in terms of its greenhouse impacts is going to be disallowed in the state, and we're going to push towards the cleaner ones. And BP, as well as campus researchers setting up this project, cited that effort and parallel efforts going on in Germany and in UK and in EU system-wide right now as part of that new framework. So you're right, we might not make it, but I do believe we need to do the research to find out if it's possible.
Professor Altieri, last words. What are you calling for now? What are the organizations on campus and outside? Because groups like Greenpeace, Essential Action have also weighed in here, concerned about the corporatization of public institutions.
I think what we need is, first of all, is to call again for an open debate, which has been suppressed, because basically the people that were questioning this have been accused of attempting against the academic freedom. And basically what academic freedom now means is Berkeley is just that you cannot question the financial associations of faculty. I mean, we need to look at the record of BP. We cannot associate with BP. It has a horrible record in terms of environment, in terms of human rights, and so on. and they have been, you know, destroying the environment for many years, and now they come as the doves of ecology. We need to also put in place people that are going to be looking critically at the social ecological impacts. We cannot leave in charge climate change and ecological questions to a bunch of engineers and chemists and genetic engineering people. We need to bring ecologists, social scientists, but also that are critical and that are independent, that are not associated with this proposal, and therefore open the debate and also bring the public of California to question their public university that is being funded by them. They need to reclaim their university, their public university.
And do you see any of this happening in the discussion?
No, I don't see that. Everything is secret. I don't know anything. None of the faculty that are not associated with this know anything about the negotiations. Professor Kamen seems to be updated, but, you know, the rest of the faculty are not aware of what's going on.
Well, we will leave it there, but follow the discussion further. I want to thank Professors Altieri and Kamen for joining us from the University of California, Berkeley. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to an interview I did with Norman Mailer in 2004. Stay with us.
Well, thank you very much.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're broadcasting from San Francisco. We're going to talk now about Norman Mailer, legendary novelist and journalist. He died at the age of 84. Norman Mailer was one of the country's best-known literary figures, one of the most famous American writers of the 20th century. Over the past six decades, he published nearly 50 books that crossed many genres, including fiction and biography, history and journalism. He won two Pulitzer Prizes and the National Book Award. He co-founded the Village Voice, which is the nation's first alternative weekly newspaper. Norman Mailer first achieved literary fame at the age of 25 with his novel The Naked and the Dead, which was based on his experiences serving in the Army in World War II. He later won the first of his two Pulitzers for his book, The Armies of the Night, based on his participation in the 1967 March on Pentagon against the Vietnam War. His book, Men and the Siege of Miami and the Siege of Chicago, is considered one of the definitive accounts of the history of that period, of the 1968 conventions. We're going to turn now to an interview that I did with Norman Mailer. It was the summer of 2004. It was right before the conventions. We spoke together in Provincetown in Massachusetts, and this is some of what he had to say.
The people who hate Bush, like myself, are heating up one end of the stick. We're getting it red hot. But we're not reaching the middle at all. Now, my feeling is that if I were a Republican, I would know how to handle that rage. I would encourage it and encourage it and encourage it. And I'd have my little people in with all the activists to create some awful, awful scenes while the conventions are on. Because you keep talking about how awful the media is in terms of its limitations. It cuts off both ends of every discussion. The media is that way for a reason, which is this country, the center of this country, the corporations, are determined to control the thing. And my argument is that unless Kerry's elected, and God knows Kerry is not Jesus Christ, nor is he Joan of Arc. He's a man slightly to the left of the middle who will play with the corporations and work with them. But nonetheless, he will have to have more of an open ear to us than the Bushings. And so our first need at this point is not to keep heating one end of the stick. It's to reach the middle. It's to reach those conservatives who don't know what we're talking about. And the immediate need is to defeat Bush. But to do that, we have to reach the middle. And the only way we can reach the middle at this late date is that if we're extraordinarily peaceful in our demonstrations before the election. Because the media are just waiting there, like coiled springs, hoping that there'll be a few maniacs who'll cut loose. Maybe there'll be a few people who'll know what to do with the American flag as far as the Republicans are concerned. And that is the Republicans are hoping that we'll make of ourselves. They're counting on that. And I would like to see the word go out to all the activists that we are walking into a tremendous trap. Why ever did the Republicans choose New York? Keep asking yourself that question. Leon Trotsky once said there are certain questions that answer themselves by being asked. And that one, you ask yourself, you'll have the answer. Why did the Republicans choose New York? Let's not walk into their trap.
Now. Well, why don't we continue in that vein? And you wrote an incredible work, Miami and the Siege of Chicago, about what happened in 1968. Why don't you talk about the Siege of Chicago and relate it to what you're talking about today?
Well, there you had, in a funny way, what you had was a reverse media, because the media covered the massacre on Michigan Boulevard. Most of you, I'm sure, know all about it. For those of you who don't, there was a huge march of demonstrators, an essentially peaceful march that went up Michigan Boulevard. And at a given moment, given the order by Mayor Daley, then, not the present, Richard Daley, but his father, the police surged into the marchers and beat them up with canes. And it was all on television. It was extraordinary television, one of the incredible moments of network television. And everyone was shocked down to the core. The Cronkites, the Rathers, whoever was there then, I don't even remember, they all were profoundly shocked. And it looked, at the moment, it looked like how awful the Republicans are going to pay for this. Quite the contrary. The Republicans won. Because out there in the core of America, the thing we have to recognize is the injustices you're talking about in the media, which have rankled me for so many years I came and talk about it, are not going to be overcome by our talking. They're going to be overcome by our acquiring bits of power more and more. I'd even argue with you that the New York Times, bad as it is today, is far better than it was 50 years ago. 50 years ago, it wasn't even written well. And the point is that to overcome, to overtake this incredible centrality of the corporation, we've got to learn guile. We've got to learn an understanding of the enemy. We've got to devote our lives to it. Not all of our lives. None of us will do that, I hope. But we have to devote a good part of our lives to recognizing that we're not going to win this war by being funnier than the Republicans. The Democrats and the left have been incredibly more funny than the Republicans for 50 years. I said this in Wellfleet last year. We've been laughing at them for 50 years, and we're further back now than when we began. The way to do it is to acquire power. And people in the middle of America are terrified of change. Very often they have bad conscience. The bad conscience comes because, to the degree that they're good Christians, which must be half of the country, they feel that they're a little too greedy to be a good Christian, and it bothers them, which is why we keep getting this brainwashing all the time, which is immensely more successful than the brainwashing that went on in the Soviet Union. That was crude. The kids saw through it. They hated it. Now the brainwashing is immensely sensitive, subtle, clever. You pointed it out all over the place what they do. I was agreeing with you every step of the way, but at the same time I kept saying, it can never be enough because we're talking to ourselves. We've got to reach into that middle. And I would just say the first step is to get Kerry elected, whatever faults he has. Once he's elected, we will have more of a voice. We're not going to have the voice. The corporation will still have the voice. But it could be the beginning of a very long march back toward at least the center of the power we need. And I'm slightly ahead, and I'm going to quit. You know?
What do you think of the role of protest? I mean, you have extensively written about it. You won the Pulitzer Prize for your book.
I'm all for protest when there's not. I'll give you an answer in one sentence. I'm all for protest when an election's not coming up. Because protests can have a huge effect, slowly, steadily, not immediately. Almost immediately, the media, particularly in America, does its best to, generally speaking, to put protests down. But over a long haul, the march on the Pentagon ended up being a success. I've said this many times, but what Lyndon Johnson saw was that 50,000 middle-class people, middle-aged and young and a few old, came to Washington, paid their way to get to Washington with the prospect of being hit over the head with a club. And Lyndon Johnson was a very canny man. He knew there was one thing about middle-class people. They didn't like getting hit over the head with a club. And if they are going to spend their money to come to Washington to protest, he was sick, because he knew if he paid the way of all the people who would come to support his war in Vietnam, he'd be lucky to get 5,000 people. So 50,000 had come this way in all fear and all determination, then there probably were somewhere between 5 million and 50 million behind them, and he didn't want to find out. It took something away from him. He brought in Clark Clifford at one point to ask him for an honest appraisal of the war in Vietnam. And Clifford said, it's a loser. Clifford was respected by Johnson because he was objective. He said, you're not going to win this war. You can't. And I think that led to, now we get into all the complications of history. It's never clean. So Johnson stepped down. Nixon came in. Nixon knew his advantage was to keep the war going for 4 years, to get reelected, et cetera, et cetera. Here we get into all the tangles. I'm saying we have to enter the land of the tangles.
Mm-hmm. Well, at the Republican convention, there are plans for a massive march of something like 250,000. Perhaps there'll be more.
I hope there's a 500,000. 500,000. At my age, it gets harder to count. But the problem may well be whether they can get permission. with Bloomberg and Pataki there.
They've now gotten permission, but it's to march on the West Side Highway, which is quite far from where the convention is taking place.
It's a long walk from the Lower East Side, where it all started.
And so you approve of this protest?
Well, I approve of protests of all sorts, depending on their position, their timing. I never approve of a protest that I think is a folly. So my point is, this protest, yes, I approve if it's peaceful. If the leaders of the activists get across the notion that it'll be a disaster if there's too much rioting, and indeed suspect the people who are rioting, they might be on another payroll altogether.
Now, you have always called yourself a third-party man. What do you think about Ralph Nader?
I met him in Chicago the other day, about a month ago. He's the nicest, most decent politician I've ever met, but I do think he's doing what I'm afraid the left and the left of center is going to do on this one, is they're going to end up handing it to Bush before it's all over. And my feeling is this, that if Bush gets it, everything we do is restricted to Provincetown and San Francisco and places like that. That, in other words, if we want to really have a say in what's going on in our country and in the world, we absolutely, absolutely have to get Kerry elected. Amy, let me finish one thought, which is, we've got to curb our rage for the next 4 months. Not put it away forever. Far from it. Far from it. This rage is legitimate. But I think it's going to be much more powerful after Kerry's in. And the reverse is true if he isn't.
When you talk about curbing the rage, do you see a difference between now and 1968 in terms of how many people across the political spectrum are angry? I mean, you have now military families who are rising up, 1,000 dead U.S. servicemen
and women. I know what you want to say. Let me interrupt, because I really got to leave. I really got to leave. There's more rage across the spectrum now.
Norman Mailer speaking in 2004 in the summer, just before the conventions. And that does it for today's broadcast. Norman Mailer has died at the age of 84. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. We're broadcasting from San Francisco.